So maybe we'll go ahead and get started. There may be some other folks that are wandering in, and we certainly welcome them to come in as well. For those of you I haven't met, I'm John Jensen. I teach at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, which is a long ways away from the Snake River and a long ways away from any salmon, unless it comes in a can, as far as I can tell from there. So some of you have been to some of the other sessions, and for those of you who haven't, I just want to be clear. My background is in philosophy and in ethics. I am by no means, I am not a scientist, I am not a fisheries biologist, I am not an expert on salmon or the Snake Rivers or any piece of that. To the extent I have expertise, which I'm not sure I have even that, it's on asking questions. And part of what I'm interested in with all my sessions this week is trying to provoke all of us to think by asking questions and using case studies primarily focused in the Northwest to sort of as a launching point for asking questions and asking bigger questions along the way. So I do want to spend some time tonight talking about what I think is this absolutely fascinating, incredibly complicated environmental policy case of what to do with, in particular, four dams on the lower Snake River that are very much tied up in the issue of declining populations of Pacific salmon from there. But I also want to take this as the opportunity to ask some of the bigger questions. And those of you who are at the session on Monday, we started with a whole bunch of specific kind of cases that I was sort of challenging people to look at, largely as a way to get at bigger questions that come out of those. What I'd like to do tonight, actually, is sort of take the opposite approach, which before we really get at the details of looking at the Snake River and salmon, I want to ask you all some bigger questions that provide some of the context from there. Largely questions about the loss of biodiversity and the what we do, what we our responsibilities are in the face of sort of loss of biodiversity as one of our environmental challenges. So we'll do a little bit of the focus stuff on Snake River, a little bit on the larger picture stuff related to biodiversity. And again, for those who've been to other sessions, this may be familiar, but I'm really interested in having all of us, all of you, engage in some of these questions. So I'm going to ask you to find a small group, whether that's people that you know close by, whether that's others, and to have some engagement with some of these questions within that small group as we go along from there, just so you are aware of where we're going. And if that doesn't fit what you were looking for, well, you have it up front, and we can sort of talk about it from there. I have a series of questions that I don't expect you to go through all of them today, but I do want to sort of say that ultimately this is more about the questions than it is the details of the Snake River case, and we'll get through some of these. Some of them big questions about endangered species, some of them specific questions about what should we do about the dams on the lower Snake River, and then if we have time at the end, there's some really interesting questions that really get into issues of taxonomy and issues of climate change that we'll get to, just so you know where we're headed. I'd like to start, though, with the summer's theme, which, depending on how long you've been around here, you've heard a lot of, this Bible verse from Ezekiel, where the river flows, life abounds. And we have heard about that from a biblical perspective. We've talked about it in different ways. And to me, this is the starting point that makes it really interesting for those of us at Holden Village to really think about the issue of Snake River. And here's why. We know where the river flows, life abounds. When the river doesn't flow, what happens to life? This is a picture of one of the dams on the lower Snake River. This is a book, if you're interested in this issue, it's not a recent book, but I would recommend to you this book by Jim Likatovich called Salmon Without Rivers, A History of the Pacific Salmon Crisis. And essentially what we know, and again I'll get into a little bit more detail, is that between the years of 1940 and 1970, there were many, many dozens of dams constructed throughout the Columbia River Basin, and we saw in roughly that same period of time a decline of about 90% in the runs of Pacific wild salmon at the same time. There were declines before that. There are continuing to be declines since that time. Certainly dams are not the only cause, but I think there's pretty good evidence to say that the dams are the primary cause of that in terms of what's happening from there. So it sort of sets this up, and I think it's a question that we have to ask ourselves. We have dramatically impacted many, if not most, of the native ecosystems. And nowhere is that more evident than it is in the Snake River and the Columbia River systems. When the river flows, life abounds. When the river doesn't flow, what happens to life? Jim Likatovich's conclusion is, we have worked for decades to recover salmon without rivers, and we've failed. And that ultimately, his conclusion in studying all the biological evidence, if we want to recover salmon, if we want life to abound, we will have to let the rivers flow again. And that is a tricky sort of thing to come to. Now, I said I wanted to start with the bigger question of the loss of biodiversity from there. And I want to set this up just to put this in the context. It's not just about salmon. Biologists around the world now talk regularly about the sixth great extinction event. If you look across the geological history of time and you look at what we understand about the abundance of life, there is a bit of a pattern of seeing a rise in the number of species followed by some sort of event that causes a mass extinction over time from there. Five times in the history, as we understand it, there have been major declines in species over time. Some of that is related to geological events. Some of it, as I understand it, they don't know exactly what caused it from there. What we do know now is that all signs are pointing from the evidence that we are in the early stages of an extinction event that appears to be more rapid than any of the previous five before. And I without getting too much into the detail, just a couple of quick quotes. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a team of biologists that study said that the biologists estimate annual loss of species at 1,000 times or more greater than historic rates. That we are seeing a very rapid loss in species. And E.O. Wilson, some of you may know, the Harvard biologist, that also just writes very interesting books out there. If the current rate of human disruption of the biosphere continues, one half of Earth's higher life forms will be extinct by 2100 from there. Wilson is particularly interested. His background comes as an entomologist. And actually what we know is that in terms of species, there's just lots and lots of bugs. And that is part of what we're seeing is the extinction there. So it's not all polar bears and wolves. It is lots of things that on the surface we may say, hey, what's wrong with losing mosquitoes? But that's part of the question I think that we need to ask ourselves as well. So what I'd like to start with is a question just about endangered species. If we make a list of environmental problems, we talk about climate change, we talk about energy issues, we talk about pollution, we talk about water, etc. How big of a problem is endangered species? And more importantly, how much should we do to try to protect and recover endangered species? I'd like to start with the big question, so we have a sense of where you're coming from in thinking about this issue before we dive into the specifics related to whether we should take dams out to try to recover salmon runs from there. So what I'd like you to do is, with at least one other person, maybe no more than four, give you a 4 or 5 minutes in conversation to ask this question: how much should we do to protect and recover endangered species? Because I think sometimes it's helpful to be forced to get a little bit more specific. Should we, on a scale of 1 to 10, do everything that we can to try to protect species? Or do you see this as something that's largely out of our hands and should not be a priority, and we should do next to nothing from there? Put a number on it. But then, of course, go beyond that to give some of the reasons that are there for a little bit. So I'd like you to find a small group. I want you to talk for a few minutes about your answer to that. Put a number on it. Talk a little bit about it within your group of folks that are there. We'll spend about 4 minutes on this, and then we'll move on to some of the others and get into the salmon stuff from there.
I'm going to go to the next one.
Let me have your attention again, if I could, please. I'm going to ask you another question, so stay in your groups for just a minute. But let's just see a real quick show of hands so we can get a sense of where people are. Raise your hand, please, if you gave it an 8, 9, or 10 in terms of importance from there. Okay, you can look around from there. If you were a 5, 6, or 7, raise your hand, please. Some in there. 4 or below, raise your hand.
There's another category.
What's that?
Called case by case.
Case by case. Okay, we will give you a case in a few minutes to look at. I'd like you may have some more time than there, but I want you also to think about the why question. Because I do think it matters partly on the case by case, but it also helps us in understanding the broader implications. So I'd like to give you a couple more minutes in your group, and then we will get into the details of the salmon case. But what are the primary reasons why we should work to protect endangered species from there? I gave you a list of 5 possibilities. We should do it because a species we save may be beneficial to humans. People often talk about the long-standing connection, particularly between plants and medicines. Yeah. Maybe that plant that seems worthless to us turns out to be a cure for cancer from there. Maybe we should do it again, focusing on the benefit to us, but people talk about how we are dependent on the tapestry of life and we should not allow the tapestry to unravel. Paul Ehrlich, the biologist, famously used the analogy of an airplane, that the earth that we are on is like an airplane. Every time we lose a species, it's like losing one of the rivets in the airplane. I think of it almost every time I'm in a plane and I look out the window. And you think, I mean, and his analogy is, okay, if I look out at that wing, just in what I can see, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of rivets there. I know that I can lose that one or that one or that one. What I don't know is at what point you lose a rivet where it's a tipping point and I might lose the wing or I might lose my ability to fly. He thinks that's what it's like in losing species on planet Earth. We're ultimately dependent upon it. We may not feel the impact of losing one or two species, but if we lose too many, we impact ourselves from there. Maybe it's an idea that all species have an equal right to life. It's not about our dependence. It's the fact that every species ought to be seen as having an equal right to life. A similar idea put in terms of a religious frame, all of God's creation is sacred. Who are we to destroy the sacredness of God's creation? Number five, we talked before about rules. Humans are, and I think there's more or less universal agreement, that we are the primary cause of the loss of biodiversity. Thus, we should fix the problems that we caused along the way. Maybe there are others. Take just a few minutes within your group to say, all right, I believe everybody here gave it over a five in terms of priority. When you think about the why, it doesn't have to be one reason, but how do you think about sort of what grounds the moral imperative to protect biodiversity? Again, back to your groups for just a few minutes, and then we'll get into the details of the Snake River case after that. You could pick one of these or some of these.
I don't know what you would choose.
Let me have your attention back up here again, if we could, please. And I want to move into the salmon case. I do just want to point out what I think is obvious just from listening to it from there. Part of one of the big questions, I think, of environmental ethics is to what extent it is grounded on anthropocentric, sort of human-centered reasons, which obviously one and two are, or to what extent it's ultimately about biocentric or ecocentric or something other than being about us. And obviously the other ones sort of go on from there. And we'll have a chance to sort of talk more about this as we go through, but let me move into the other stuff from there. One other big question, which we won't take time to talk about here, but is asking about it from a more personal frame, that we as Christians, I think there is this long sort of history of an ambivalence within the Christian community about environmental issues in general, but I think endangered species issues specifically from there. And some of that comes from the focus, and particularly in certain areas of the Christian community, about focus on the end times. Do we need to be worried about these issues, or is this something ultimately that God will take care of? There's this ongoing debate about whether James Watt, who was the Secretary of Interior back in the time of the Reagan era, he is often quoted as saying, "We don't need to worry about endangered species because the second coming is at hand." Now, did he say it and now denies it? Did he not say it and got misquoted because it was useful to somebody else from there? The reality is it does actually represent the viewpoint of at least some Christians from there. On the other hand, I think some people say that if you have a view of stewardship, to say humans have a unique role as caretakers of creation, we actually have an extra responsibility. There's a stronger argument for saying that we as Christians need to do something about salmon or endangered species in general. We're the gardeners. We're the ones who God left in charge of creation, and we've messed things up. So we have an added responsibility to do something about it from there. So that's another piece of the puzzle from there. What I'd like to do is get into some of the details of the Snake River case. Somebody said it's a case by case. The answer always is it depends. Depends on the question. It depends on the case in terms of where you're at from there. I'd like to show you a few graphics, talk a little bit about salmon biology, talk about sort of where things stand, and then bring it back to both take questions, but also to ask about what ought to be done from here. Again, I want to emphasize, I am by no means an expert. I studied the case of Pacific salmon in a fair amount of depth about 10 years ago, and then have taught about it various times since then. This is a map of the Columbian Snake River Basin, as you can see from there, that it is a huge area. And if you look at the four red lines in the middle here, these indicate the four dams that are the primary focus as we look at things right now. But it gives you the bigger picture of the map throughout the Northwest and in other places from there. What I'd like to do is talk just a little bit about the life cycle of Pacific salmon, because I think it's really important to understand why, to understand at least a little bit about salmon in order to be able to understand why these dams are so important. And let me take us to a different place here because I think this will help to look at it from there. This is a simple graphic that comes from the government. Lots and lots of government agencies involved in looking at this that sort of goes through from there. So if we start at the upper part of the watershed, in the wild, spawning females dig shallow gravel nests where they lay their eggs and the males fertilize them. So high up is where we see that the eggs are first hatched there. And this takes place throughout the region, throughout the sort of mountain west, if you will, from there. In hatcheries, biologists capture the remaining adult fish because at this point they're interested in trying to do what they can to enhance what's happening. But the little ones head downstream. They live in the river for a while until they head down from there. Historically, they would have moved fairly rapidly through the system with the flush of spring floods headed downstream. Lots of snow melt, lots of sort of rushing water heading downstream. The young fry are sort of washed out to sea as part of that. Not so much so anymore. And as they migrate, they're sort of heading downstream from there, but there are things along the way. And Most Columbia Basin salmon and steelhead pass one or more dams on their way to the ocean. The one or more, many salmon migrating downstream, trying to make their way downstream, may pass as many as 10 dams as they go downstream from there. People think that the problem with dams and salmon is getting upstream again from there. So if we come down, assuming they can survive, they pass down. After they've been in the ocean for a while, they start coming back up again. And so they head again, heading upstream from there. And there are fish ladders that we're aware of. They're sort of heading upstream from there. It's not as big a problem for salmon to get up over the dams. We've done a good job of creating fish ladders, of finding ways for salmon to get back up. The bigger problem where there's much more mortality is on the downstream run. Whereas they used to be, in a sense, flushed out to sea in fairly cold water, what happens is you're a young fish that's heading downstream. You're through that nice cold stream like Railroad Creek out here that's heading you down. And all of a sudden, you hit this warmer, very slow-moving water behind one of these dams. And it's a combination of things that partly it takes a lot more effort for the fish to swim through that slow-moving water, but they're also much more subject to predation at that point, assuming they can get through. In some cases, you're talking about, I think, up to 100 miles of slack water behind some of these dams. Assuming they can make their way up to the dam, then they've got to get through the dam. And there has been a lot of work and a lot of money that's been put into trying to get salmon into places to go down, but in some cases they pass through the turbines and they may or may not survive along the way. So what you see in many of these cases when they study it is greater than 99% mortality of the downstream salmon that are heading back out to the ocean from there. And so that is part of the issue that is there, but they are dependent on, they're an incredibly unique species in the sense that they are adapted to both fresh and salt water. That they're born in fresh water, they travel down long distances to get out to sea, they live in the sea, but then in order to reproduce, they travel back upstream, the same hundreds of miles in many cases, trying at least to return to the areas where they were born again in order to lay eggs and to reproduce again. And so it's a very unique system that they can survive in both fresh and salt water from there. Coming back, so it's that sort of cycle of life from birth through the young fish heading downstream out to the ocean, coming back again in order to be able to lay eggs again. It's just this absolutely fascinating sort of system. And the salmon in the Pacific are what biologists call a keystone species. They're not just like another species. There are so many other creatures that depend upon the salmon. And there's also this sort of tremendous history, particularly of Native peoples, of American Indians, being dependent upon the salmon as part of their culture, as the sort of heart of their livelihood from there. If we look here now, there are seven different species that sort of fall within that realm of Pacific salmon from there. Here is the Columbia River heading out from here. There are four large dams along the Columbia. And then the focus here, if you go further up on the Columbia, there are far more from there. The focus is really on these four dams in far eastern Washington and before the snake heads off, and there are other dams upstream from there. This is a different view that shows those dams, again, out to the Pacific Ocean, the big dams along the Columbia, and then the Ice Harbor, Lower Monumental, Little Goose, and Lower Granite. These dams were put in between, I think, 1962 and 1970, and they were part of the era of big dam building. Many of you may remember that better if you were in the West at the time, or those of us from the Midwest, not so much, say, in places like Minnesota, but when I lived in Kansas for a while, there are all these series of reservoirs that were put in by the Army Corps of Engineers at that time. And so it was a big era in terms of building lots of dams at the time from there. Here's to give you an image of what's there. The Ice Harbor Dam is the lowest or the westernmost of those dams. And they serve four things, four purposes, I guess, when we think about it. In many, they are for transportation. This makes possible barges moving up and down the Snake River that primarily carry agricultural commodities, although they carry other things as well. So there is a lock and dam system, which you can see in the foreground here as well. And it's a fairly efficient way to move things along. Lots of people point out that if you were to remove these dams, you would effectively take out this as a barge channel. And when you do the analysis based on energy, it takes far more energy to move the same commodities by rail or by truck than it would to move them by barge. They also move things upstream in terms of industrial goods, but it's primarily as an agricultural passageway. They're for irrigation. The estimates are that at least 35,000 acres of irrigated cropland would be lost if these dams were taken out. Not to, you couldn't still take some of it out, but by providing some storage, you sort of deal with the seasonality of rivers related to that. So they're a major source of irrigation, and this is very arid land. And so you would lose some of that cropland, or else it would have to change significantly. They are hydroelectric dams. And so, as some of you know, that the Northwest is powered significantly by hydroelectricity, and these are all hydroelectric dams that would be lost if the dams were removed from there, and they're a source of recreation. So that for boating, jet skis, skiing, other sorts of things behind there. And so the dams serve multiple purposes along the way. The idea again, and I want to step back for just a second, is that, well, let me go back to here, is that, here's where I'm not a biologist, and this is incredibly complicated stuff, but even though there are these other dams, the fisheries biologists that have studied this believe that these dams are, in some sense, a significant bottleneck, that they are a bigger problem than the larger dams on the lower Columbia, and that they open up enough possibilities in terms of upstream possibilities that they think that there is a real chance that removing those four dams would have a significant impact on improving the runs of Pacific salmon. I have to be honest, I don't think I can explain exactly why that is. But that's what the fisheries folks have focused on, these dams as the sort of major problem. It doesn't solve everything. There are 214 distinct runs of Pacific salmon. The information that, as I understand where it is, and this can change over time obviously, is that roughly 40% of those runs are already extinct. That of the rest of them, roughly half of the remaining ones are seen as endangered. And the others, some of them are doing okay, but almost all of those distinct runs are in significantly bad shape from there. The idea is that if we could remove that bottleneck, I think the best way to say it is they hope that that would make a big difference, and that's a hope that has been based on years and years of study. So the proposal is to take out those four dams. This has been around for over a decade. It's been tied up in the courts. Well, it's been tied up in the courts for a decade. It's been on the table for at least 20 years that is out there, and it has gone through various sort of cycles. The latest in terms of dam removal that I heard is the federal judge that has been hearing this case for the last 10 years retired last fall. But this spring, he came out publicly to say, based on my looking at this case, hearing all the arguments, I think we should remove the dam. So he wasn't in a position to say that while he was sitting on the bench at the time. What he has said repeatedly is that the plans that have come from the government to take care of the salmon are insufficient. So we have the sort of governing legislation here is the Endangered Species Act, passed in 1973, most famously associated with the bald eagles at that time. We have on the books that if it is determined by the federal government that a species is endangered, then the federal government is required to come up with a recovery plan for every species that it has been deemed to be endangered. The government, I have to say, usually fights the claims that a species is endangered because it's a big responsibility for them. As a general rule, it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that is responsible for those species recovery plans. The salmon are a very unique case, as we were talking about before, because they are both a freshwater land-based creature and also a sea creature. And it's actually two different government agencies that are responsible for endangered species, for things in the sea versus things in freshwater from there. So it is the National Marine Fisheries Service as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that cooperate on trying to come up with salmon recovery plans. Lots of criticism of the Bush administration for not taking seriously salmon recovery. The Obama administration came in, spent a bunch of time, put a bunch of priority. We're going to figure out how to do this. They came up with their plan for what to do. It went to the courts, and the judge said, get this out of here. This is not sufficient to save salmon, essentially, from there. So it's tied up in the courts again, and we're waiting to see sort of what happens next coming out of that from there. Again, the four dams that are there, the purposes of the dams that are there, people have said for a long time that we can't remove dams. It's too complicated. We'll never get it done from there. And so I wanted to give a couple of cases within the last year that we have sort of moved into actually doing dam removal in other places. The Elwha River on the Olympic Peninsula, they had talked for years about removing this. There were two dams on the Elwha River that had prevented some historic runs of king salmon. Some of the largest king salmon, over 100 pounds in some cases, were not able to get up to there. And so they had worked for, again, decades on trying to do this. I remember as of last summer, people were saying, they'll never pull that off. They were trying, but they hadn't done it. The picture up above shows what the Elwha Dam had looked like originally. This is as of this spring. They have not completely removed everything that's there because one of the concerns is the sediment that builds up behind the dam. So essentially what they're trying to do is to slowly let the water out from there in order to try to keep a bunch of the sediment in place so it wouldn't all go out from there. Some people are hoping that they will see a significant increase in the runs of salmon on the Elwha River within a year. Other biologists are saying there's no way it'll happen that fast, but we think within 10 years, we hope that this will sort of have recovered it from there. So this is something that's happened in the last year in the Northwest, much, much smaller scale, very different project. There's never been a dam removal anywhere in the world on the scale that it would take on the Salmon River Dam, or the Snake River Dams from there.
There's also a second dam on the Elwha that they're still working on.
That's right, yep.
Working on the removal.
And my understanding is that's all sort of moving forward, that the challenges aren't there after they got to the first one, whether that's, maybe you know more about it than I do, but I think they think it's going to happen this year. But this I saw in the newspaper just before we left, June 11th, 2012, on the other side of the country, the Penobscot River in Maine. This is called the Great Works Dam, and that they're in there taking that dam out again. The headline from the New York Times, dam removal to help restore spawning grounds. Obviously not Pacific salmon, but the fact, I think people for years had said we will never really remove dams. Within the last few months, we see this happening in a very active way on both coasts from here. So the big question is, what should we do along the way? I want to be honest that I don't think anybody knows with certainty what happens if you take those dams out. The best available scientific information from the fisheries biologists, and this is contentious as well, is that we will probably continue to see declines in Pacific salmon unless we can do something more significant than we've seen so far. They've put literally billions of dollars into trying to improve the passageways around the dams. But it has not resulted in significant improvement over time. Some people think we should wait and see, but this is where it stands. I'd like to take questions about it, but also sort of lay out, I think, the series of options. Obviously, there's an infinite number of them, but number one is to do nothing, is to sort of say, hey, wait and see. Particularly if you're on the lower end of the priority that you put on saving endangered species, the one estimate I saw for removal of Snake River dams, I think, was $350 million. To take that out. Some people think it could be done cheaper than that. Obviously, that doesn't account for the losses that take place in terms of the economic losses, in terms of irrigation, in terms of transportation and the other things. Although, as is the way with these things, there are competing studies on what the economic impact would be. But one recent study showed that removal of dams would create 15,000 new jobs. These are estimates, I think, on both sides. But obviously, there would be big impacts. We could focus more on hatchery salmon. We do already have an extensive system of hatcheries that breed salmon, but in the minds of lots of people, they are inferior. They are not the same as the wild salmon that existed there before, certainly not with the same sort of diversity that was there. Option three, tweak, watch, and wait. Essentially, this is what was proposed by the federal government, by the Obama administration, is to say, let's do more with fish ladders, let's try to improve the passages of what's there, but let's wait and see what happens before we take any drastic actions. I think the concern among lots of folks that are advocates for recovering salmon is that waiting and seeing is a little bit like the dinosaurs on the island watching things go away, that extinction is forever. And once things are gone, you might be waiting and watching to see what happens, but it may be too late to do something at that point. There's a long history of trying technological fixes, and I put this one up there. There has been a proposal coming particularly out of Idaho, some researchers there, to say really what we ought to do is build a huge pipeline. And they're talking about using sound waves to gather the downstream migrating fish into particular places and building pipelines. In one case, they're talking 35 miles long. People have talked about it even longer than that, that would be anchored to the bottom or would be floating in places. And essentially, they'd use a system of pumps to essentially try to get the fish into a pipeline and pump them past all the dams. Again, we tend to, when we first think about it, think getting upstream over the dams is the hard part. When you remember it's going downstream is the harder part, that's what dominates this from there. It's interesting, I think, in the broader issue in terms of saying, how confident are we in a technological fix? It comes back to Jim Likatovich saying you can't have salmon without rivers. That his conclusion in studying it is the technological fixes won't work. It's only free-flowing rivers. It's only when the river flows that life abounds, that when you think about it from there. Are there other options? Or should we go the way that the most ardent sort of defenders of wild salmon say, and we should remove the dams, that we should go forward and take those out and sort of take what goes along with it? I would like to sort of ask you to go back and talk about it a little bit, but let me take questions about the broader situation. I sort of went through a bunch of this quickly.
How much, what's the sentiment of the people that live in the Palouse in that area? Are they really anti this? Is there anything going on with them?
Certainly that there are a wide range of different opinions, and I want to be clear that I don't live in that area. Does anybody live in eastern Washington here that could speak to that question better? It's pretty divided between people, but my understanding is that if when they do polls on the local folks in eastern Washington, folks tend to be opposed to the dam removal. And the politicians, this is a very political issue, surprise, surprise, that there's the politicians in Idaho and in Washington have tended to be opposed to the dam removal. Politicians in Oregon, not so much so. But I think the heart of the sort of dam removal advocates are actually in western Washington and Oregon. And there's a little bit, it matches the political divide within these states between east and west from there. But there are different views, and certainly there are some types of economic activity that the dams have taken out over time, particularly some of the fishing that would take place. Some of the sport fishing that would be available in these places is not available.
There are a few communities in eastern Washington like Moses Lake and Othello and some of those communities that years ago didn't have any farming of any kind, and right now farming is very good.
Yep.
And a lot of those people and a lot of those communities would have a tremendous economic impact.
Yep. No, I think that's right. I think it would be very hard on the farming communities, I understand it. I have seen people that have sort of countered by saying this tends to be fairly large farms. So the actual number of people that would be impacted is not that large. But I think you put it nicely to say certain communities would be very hard hit.
Yeah.
But 35,000 acres isn't a lot if they're 3,000-acre farms or something like that. But I think that's right. What other questions? Are there things that... Yeah?
Does taking out one dam tell you anything?
That's a good question. And... I don't think we know the answer to it, but my sense from studying this is that people tend to think it's an all or nothing, that essentially you would not gain much by taking out only one or two of the dams, that in a sense you probably gain a little bit, but you wouldn't see a significant rise unless they're all gone, so that whole sort of area is free-flowing again. But again, I don't think we know.
How long have the dams that have been removed? Like this one you said was just a year?
Yeah, we do not have a history of dam removal.
What would happen if a dam was removed then?
Right. Yep.
The four dams have been in place for 40 years now, since 1970?
Yeah, I think 72 maybe was the last one that went in.
So roughly 40 years. And what's been the population pattern? Has it been a gradual decrease in terms of fish population, do we know, or is it leveled off? It seems like from the are extinct already, kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a steady decrease from there, but I do think it's a continuing downward trend. And it's a good question. I don't remember exactly what that historical sort of trend looks like.
I know biologists point to a more rapid decrease after those dams were built.
Right. And then, but I think it sort of went down, but then has continued to go down a little bit. But I don't know exactly what it looks like. Say, if you look at the last, if you look at that 40 years, exactly what does that graph look like?
Yeah. Can you say anything more about how Pacific salmon is viewed? It's unique relative to its life cycle and so on. For us folks in Iowa, a real salmon versus a farm salmon, I can get along with those kinds of things, but that is not the question, I don't think. Is it the
yeah, it is? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it comes back to the reason of why do we want to preserve these things. Yes. Certainly, the consumption of salmon worldwide has gone up almost exponentially in the last 10 years. There's been a huge increase in the amount of salmon that is eaten as it's become more. But as you said, that's mostly salmon that comes from salmon farms. And there are still healthy wild salmon fisheries, particularly in Alaska. And not to do a commercial, but we'll talk about mining tomorrow. And part of what I want to talk about is a mine that people are really worried will have a huge impact on the salmon fishery in the Bristol Bay region of Alaska from there. But most of that is farmed salmon, and there are a whole set of issues with farmed salmon that is there. I mean, down to the fact that I remember someone showing me once that they have their color chart, which is just like what you would do with paint chips, that in different places people like their salmon more or less red or orange, and that's largely artificial dyes that are being used as part of the feeds in order to produce the color that you want on your salmon depending on where you are. Yes?
I guess I'd like to know why the four are so critical here, and even if they were removed, could someone be saying that's just the first and the start of removing all of them? Why are those four impacting it that way? Won't we just be passing the problem on to the next dam?
Yeah, I mean, so I think in response, I do think, to be honest, some folks would like to see this as step one in an eventual process to remove far more dams that are out there. I don't think they're saying that publicly, but I do think that for some advocates, that's where they see it going from there. But it does seem to be the case that these four dams present a particular bottleneck, that there is reason to believe from the fisheries biologist that they are more significant. But we don't know that, and I do think some people would like to see more of them go beyond that. Other questions?
Well, along those lines, if you were to take out those four and also implement pipeline technology fixes in various places, it seems like that would be a reasonable experimental data point, mm-hmm. as a scientist, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if people argued that way and trying to apply points 1 through 4 in different areas to do a case-by-case attempt at fixing more than one issue at a time, rather mm-hmm. than if you were to take all the dams out or take those four out.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that take those out, but also do other things at the same time and try to see what's happening?
Okay. Yeah, And if you do notice that the LWOT does well after 2 years instead of 10, and that this does well, then that gives you a lot of understanding that you can't get through the dam, you can't get through the dam.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of talk about what scientists talk about is adaptive management, which is sort of trying something, watching to see if it's working, and trying to adapt it as you go along from there. It really does seem to be that those four dams right now is kind of a line in the sand that the folks that are really interested in recovering salmon are saying, we need to have this and these other things, and the others are saying there's no way that we can go to that point from there. But I do think it taking those out can't be seen as the only thing that you do. There needs to continue to be work in other areas. I mean, one of the things that has threatened salmon as well is logging practices in the upper reaches of the tributaries that cause tremendous amounts of erosion and end up, you know, sediment that covers over the gravel bars where they spawn is also another problem. You know, the fact that they get there, they've got good habitat once they get there as well. So that's another piece of it. Yeah.
I don't see how hatcheries can actually be a solution, because another part of the problem is it's not just the fish that we consume, it's for everything up that whole stream that mm-hmm. feeds on the fish. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's really a viable solution.
Yeah, well, again, I think it comes back to what the values are that are behind it. I mean, the assumption that's there, which I think I share, is that we have a responsibility to think about the broader sweep of other creatures that are dependent upon them, not just upon the sort of commercial side of it from there. But that certainly isn't a value that's shared by everybody that is involved in this debate. And I think some folks say that, you know, the bears don't eat upstream, well, they'll find something else to eat, or that's not our problem, or we'd be better off if we didn't have bears as well. And I just want to sort of be aware of the broader things there. Yeah.
Question. As part of this plan, have the people come forth with a plan, if they take these dams out, what is going to supplant the power that was provided by these things? Mm-hmm. Are they going to go for coal-generated power plants, or is it part of the plan at all?
Yeah, so it certainly has been addressed a lot. And there are two things that people point out that are sort of related to this. One is that within the grand sweep of sort of hydroelectric dams in the Pacific Northwest, this is a relatively small amount of the power that we're talking about. So it's, as I understand it, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 5% or less than the hydroelectric power, say, within the state of Washington from there. And then what folks want to say then on top of that is to say it wouldn't take a lot in terms of basic efficiency and trying to bring things up, to make them more efficient than they are now in order to make up for the lost energy that's coming from there. It is interesting, for those of us who live in other places, electricity is really cheap here. And as a result, it is not, at least as I've seen, used as, you know, when something is really cheap, we don't use it as carefully as we do in other places. And I think that's part of what I've observed anyway, and just being around Washington a little bit. And so I don't think it would take a lot to do that. There's also a debate going on in the region about the future of wind power. And some of the folks that are salmon advocates are saying wind power could easily replace what we're losing from hydroelectric. But I do think it's part of the trade-off for environmentalists is to say, okay, you care about green energy and you care about salmon, and how does that sort of, where does that go? Other questions? Yeah.
I have two related thoughts here. It doesn't matter what we decide here. The government's got to put together a proposal that under the current law, and this is going to go to my second point, but under the current law, it's going to satisfy a judge, will save the salmon. So we're not going to get it. The government committee's not going to get it. Nobody but that federal judge is going to get the opportunity to say, yeah, let's try this for a while. We can all work on putting proposals together, but it's going to come down to that one question. Is that federal judge satisfied that this will save the salmon?
Yeah. Let me answer that, and then I think you have the second question, right, too, which is, I haven't studied this as extensively, but looking at endangered species cases and other cases, and particularly in Colorado, where I did my graduate school there, there is a sort of a recognition by lots of people that we, with endangered species, we often have come up against a sort of a confrontational approach that is generally not good for the species and not good for anybody else. So there is sort of, there are precedents in other places. If opposing sides can come together and come up with a plan that they think might work, and have as part of that sort of a monitoring and adapting program in place, it seems like the courts are willing to say, we're not sure if this is good enough, but we're willing to let you try it for a while and see if it will work. So the rhetoric that at least is coming out of some of the most ardent defenders of sort of dam removal is saying, let's have a stakeholder process and try to come up with a collaborative solution that is going to move this forward. I think they're looking at it and saying that if this stays in the courts for another 10 years, that's not for anybody's benefit. Let's try to find sort of a compromise solution that might work to go forward. And it may well come back to this, let's remove a dam and see what we see as part of that, or let's try some sort of system from there. So that's sort of where I'm basing some of this on from there.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you're right. There's law that's in place, and a judge has to sort of enforce that law.
Now, all these assume we want to save the salmon. A number five could be, there is a provision in the Endangered Species Act for saying, a process for saying, all right, we don't want to apply the Endangered Species Act to this species anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's proposed that, and it would cause quite a political uproar for the administration to propose that.
That's right.
But there is that provision there.
Yep. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's the question is, do we want to preserve these? And let me just see, it gets a little bit more complicated, and we're not going to have time to get into all of this because we have to get to Vespers, but just a couple of more questions. How important is to preserve wild salmon when we have abundant salmon from hatcheries? I mean, your point is that they aren't quite the same, it's not going to sort of feed it in the same way, but it isn't as if we don't have salmon at all, and the hatchery technology is getting better from there. But I also wanted to raise, there's two other sort of bigger questions that are at work here, and I'll throw these out there and then we can take some more. But in particular, I wanted to ask this question about species. So I said before there were 214 distinct runs. There's actually only 7 species that we're talking about here. But it's sort of a little known provision of the Endangered Species Act that doesn't say that we only protect species. There is in place there, sort of within the law, the possibility of both listing as endangered and providing the protection for subspecies or other types of what they call evolutionarily significant units. Or in this case, it's often distinct population segments. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. They think, oh no, we're going to save species. It's probably the case that we could continue to have others of these runs that go extinct without actually causing the species to go extinct along the way from there. And it's interesting, do we only want to save species, or do we want to protect biodiversity at all different levels, if you will, from there? And this has come up in other cases as well. If we can show that the wolves that used to live in the northeastern part of the United States were distinct from the western wolves, does that mean we need to reintroduce wolves in New York in the same way that we did in Yellowstone? Well, perhaps. And I think then lots of people say, no, that's not what we mean. We don't want to worry about saving every bit. We just think there's something special about species along the way. And I think that's part of what gets added here. I mean, you could, within the Endangered Species Act, say, it's at least possible to say, no, we're going to let all these runs go as long as we can save at least 2 of them of each species. So instead of 214 runs, we end up with 14 runs, but there's at least 2 for each part of it from there. So it gets a little bit more complicated. And the other question I think that complicates it further, how does climate change impact the situation of protecting biodiversity, and specifically dam removal? We talked about losing the hydroelectric power. And obviously one of the things that people are focusing on everywhere is say, how do we get more green power? You know, where I live, it's 85% coal that is feeding into the electricity grid. You know, the Northwest has one of the best fuel mixes from a carbon point of view that's out there. Do we want to be pulling that away? But the other part of it is to say, given the changes that are taking place with climate change, might we go to extraordinary efforts to try to protect a species, only for that species to be lost based on climatic changes that are taking place out there anyway? I mean, some of the estimates are that not with new development, but just looking at the climatic changes are that we could lose 30% of the world's species in the next 100 years based on the sort of rapid climate change that we're looking at from there. How does that sort of factor into things here? Should that make us less willing to take extraordinary measures for biodiversity protection because it's more complicated to know what the impacts will be given a changing climate? Or should we say, given what we know we're going to lose, we better do everything we can to make sure the rivers flow freely because there's going to be all these other challenges that are there as well? Hard questions, not answers, but some interesting cases, I think, that are out there. Are there other questions about the Pacific or about the Snake River salmon or the dams that are there?
Is there anything different about the role of the courts in this case? I mean, traditionally, in other areas, the courts don't find the best solution. They look at the proposal from the Obama administration and say it's inadequate. Mm-hmm. That won't do. So mm-hmm. they say no to that.
Yep.
And don't they have to say yes or no to this side or that side as opposed to how is it we get in creative thinking into the courts about, I mean, even bringing ethics in, is it buried in the court system, prohibited from the court system? Is there anything different about the courts handling this issue than handling other issues that courts are asked to issue?
I mean, you're right in that here the courts are not really deciding between two different parts. They have to decide whether what the government is putting forward is sufficient or not. Uh-huh. It does get more complicated in that lots of different parties weigh in on that mm-hmm. matter. Mm-hmm. And in particular, those advocates of dam removal are weighing in to say this proposal is not adequate, and here's why. And here's my 5-foot stack of science that backs up what's behind it, and that in this case, particularly the Bonneville Power Authority, which is one of the major ones that are sort of coming in, is sort of weighing in on the other side. I think if there's a unique role, it comes back to what I said before, is that it's up to the judge, but a willingness to sort of allow time for a cooperative solution to go forward. If all the parties or enough of the parties are sort of on board, would be stretching the law a little bit, but I think the courts have shown a willingness to sort of look at that.
Is there any, I'd say, retroactive or introspective thought on how these dams were developed and put in the first place? Can we learn something from what appears to be a mistake? And I wondered if you know of anything that's been looked at along those lines. Whether it was investigated, even thought about, of the ramifications of the side effects. A lot of drugs are used, and then we find out there's 75 side effects that are worse than the disease that was cured. I just wondered if any of this has been investigated at all.
No, I mean, from what I've read about it, it is the case that they weren't thinking about salmon at the time they put the dams in place. And so we've learned that we need to pay more attention to what the bigger impacts will be. And we're not building very many dams these days.
Right.
And we haven't really for the last 40 years, for the most part. Although there is renewed talk about hydroelectric power and how that can be used as part of the energy mix that is going on from there. But I don't hear a lot of that. So I don't hear a lot of it other than to say, oops, we should have thought about this before. But I don't think that's what you're looking
for.
No,
I was just wondering if anyone is taking the time to investigate, if there's any organization, group, committee, or anything like that that says, let's go back and retroactively evaluate this. Because the Marble Canyon area in Grand Canyon was a prime place for a dam, and it was practically ready to go in. And in the 70s, in the 60s, it started to be reacted against, and it was never brought in. Mm-hmm. They did do Glen Canyon Dam, mm-hmm. and they did do Lake Mead or Hoover Dam.
Right.
But they, for some reason, and I don't remember why, I think it was the Sierra Club perhaps,
yep.
Said this isn't going to happen, and they lobbied and politically squashed it.
Yep.
But I'm looking at it not from a political standpoint, but from a scientific standpoint.
And it's a really interesting case, sort of from a kind of political historical, in that case where David Brower, mm-hmm. who was the very strong leader of the Sierra Club at that time, essentially compromised on, if we don't do this one, we can go ahead and do those and we won't fight it, and basically said he went to his grave regretting that compromise. Yeah. I mean, he was kind of a fighter and believed that he should have fought harder. But, I mean, he did get something out of it.
I would guess that as recently as 1970, there were many experts at the time that knew exactly what was going to happen, and they did not prevail. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably right, although I don't hear as much about it.
But the first dam, when they built Bonneville, I mean, there were enough salmon to walk across the river on, and nobody ever thought it would even be, they were sacrificed then, so.
Right. Well, if anyone has ever seen films of Celilo Falls, that was a Native American fishing place, mm-hmm. this amazing falls that was covered by the lake behind Bonneville Dam. It's amazing that we, by building that dam, were willing to destroy such a natural beauty.
And I do think it comes back fundamentally to attitudes that people had. I mean, I think part of it was that, I mean, to be honest, people thought there were so many salmon, they couldn't imagine yeah. that you could do anything that would actually cause that to go extinct. I mean, you have such an abundance, you don't think you can do it. But also, a strong belief that we still have today in technological fixes, that we will be able to figure out how to do this. And that, to me, is what's so interesting about the pipeline
yes.
alternative, is that it's another type of technological fix. And I do think, ultimately, it comes down to how we see the role of technology in addressing lots of different issues and what the possibilities are.
I'd be curious, among us here, before you got to this slide, how many were imagining a pipeline in your mind? I was.
I was looking at number five.
I'd remove every single mile.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.